Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in Big Ideas and the editor-in-chief of the network. And each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week I'm happy to say that we have Suzanne Mettler on the show, and we'll be talking about her fascinating book, Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. I've been a professor for a long time, and I found this book extraordinarily interesting because it sheds a kind of new light on what is happening in my industry, if I may so speak. A lot of changes going on in academia right now, and Suzanne really did a lot to sort of open my eyes as to what is in fact transpiring. So let me say to Suzanne, thank you for writing the book and welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. Could you kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I am a professor of government, which is really political science, at Cornell University, and I study American politics and public policy, and I've written a variety of books about American social and educational policies from the New Deal to the present.
Mm-hmm. So why did you write Degrees of Inequality?
Well, I wrote a book many years ago about the World War II GI Bill, and I interviewed veterans and surveyed them, and I was really struck by the big story of the GI Bill, which was that it was a landmark public policy in the United States that enabled men of the World War II generation to acquire far more education and advanced training than they would have otherwise. And I found that they not only got the opportunity through that to really join the ranks of the middle class, but in addition, it enabled them to become more active and involved citizens than they would have been otherwise. They joined more civic organizations, they took part in politics more, and so the overall impact on the United States was that it was a democratizing public policy that included people more fully in public life. So when I finished that book, I was becoming increasingly interested in and concerned about rising economic inequality in the United States, which has been a trend since the early 1970s and has been growing dramatically in the past couple of decades. And so I wondered to what extent contemporary public policies are giving young Americans the sort of opportunity that the GI Bill did for people of the World War II generation. And so this was about 2005, 2006 that I began the project of trying to look at what contemporary educational policies are doing. And that's what led to this current book.
Mm-hmm. So the backdrop to the book is the thesis, and it's correct, that the GI Bill moved a lot of Americans into the middle class, and it obviously made them better citizens, as you say. Is a failure to do this, or is the fact that this is not happening anymore, is that the sort of contemporary phenomenon that you're talking about in the book? That is, that higher education is no longer this conveyor belt into the middle class and into good citizenry?
Well, today, on the one hand, there are more Americans than ever who attend college. So at first blush, you would look at the contemporary circumstances and say, wow, we're doing even better now than we were back in the middle of the 20th century. Of course, having a college degree is more important than ever to how a person does subsequently in terms of their income and their opportunities in the job market. So at first blush, you would think we're doing better because more people than ever go to college. But when you look at who ends up actually graduating and getting a college degree and the value of that degree, what you'll find is that the big increases have been for people in the bottom quarter of the in the top quarter of the income spectrum. And for everyone else, the improvements have been pretty modest since the 1970s. And so today, for people below median income, they're barely more likely to get a four-year college degree than they were back in the 1970s. And then to make matters even worse and more complicated, what matters today is not just whether or not a young person goes to college, but where they attend, because there are some schools from which people can enroll in them and end up worse off than if they'd never enrolled in the first place, because they have very low graduation rates and end up taking on an exorbitant amount of student debt for which they're on the hook. So they can really be worse off than if they'd never enrolled in college.
Mm-hmm. So college going rates have not increased for the bottom quarter of the college going age population since about 1970, right?
Well, the percentage of people who enroll in college has improved, but the college graduation rates have barely improved.
Yeah,
so today it's only 1 out of 10 young Americans in the bottom quarter of the income spectrum who gets a 4-year college degree by age 24. Mm-hmm. So that's just a couple of percentage points improvement since the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I recall the statistics correctly, I'm sorry to interrupt. I think it's about 1 in 2 Americans try to go to college, and really about a quarter of them actually make it through. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah,
that's
again, I'm sorry.
Right. So almost everyone in the top quarter of the income spectrum goes to college, and 71% of them have completed college degrees by the time they're 24 years old.
Right. So a question that I had, and since we brought it up in the statistics, if half of the people that go to college don't actually graduate, that's a lot of people. And so is the fault that they aren't graduating? I mean, obviously, the students have to bear some of the fault. But isn't the failure to graduate these people very, very widely distributed among all colleges? I mean, are there colleges that are just that just almost nobody graduates from? I used to teach an institution that had almost 100% graduation rate.
Yes.
I mean, they were, if you were in, you were in, and they were going to get you through. And I've also taught at institutions that are around 75% or 50%. They're both fine places.
Yeah. Well, college graduation rates vary dramatically, both by demographic group and also by the institutions that a young person attends. Mm-hmm. So if someone grows up very low income and goes to schools that don't give them much preparation for college, it's not surprising that for people in those demographic groups, their college graduation rates are going to be poor, because they'll get into college, they're going to have a hard time with the courses and a hard time affording it. And that gets to public policy issues right away, which we can talk about in a minute. Mm-hmm. But what also matters is the institution where you attend. And that matters because, some institutions are offering students really small classes with a lot of interaction with faculty. They're offering almost entirely classes in brick and mortar settings rather than online courses. If a young person comes from a disadvantaged background, enrolls in a school where their classes are going to be mostly online or huge classes where they don't get much interaction with a professor, their chances of graduating are going to be much less. Mm-hmm. It also makes a difference if their institution is able to provide much support, academic support outside of the classroom, and other kinds of support that enable people from less advantaged backgrounds to really be able to succeed. Mm-hmm. And so what you find is that the private elite institutions are able to put a lot of resources into education in those ways and can really have great success rates for people from less advantaged backgrounds, whereas our public institutions are increasingly stretched because states have really been pulling back in terms of how much they invest in higher education, and we should talk more about that. Mm-hmm. And then also because we have this rapidly growing sector of for-profit education, particularly the large for-profits that have mostly online degrees. And those schools particularly try to recruit people who come from less advantaged backgrounds. They're often the first in their families to go to college. And, you know, that in itself is terrific that they're finding ways to incorporate those students. What's problematic is when you look at how the students actually fare in those schools. these success rates are really poor, graduation rates of, you know, 22% on average, and many of the schools much less than that. And yet nearly all of the students who attend those schools, which charge very high tuition relative to public universities and colleges, most of the students borrow, over 90% do. They borrow very large amounts to attend, so they end up really worse off in many cases than if they'd never attended in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I don't know quite which direction to go. One question I had, and this I think a lot of people don't understand, what's the difference between a for-profit college or university and a not-for-profit college and university?
So a not-for-profit college or university, this is, you know, most of our institutions in the United States fall into this category. This includes the traditional privates, and it includes the all of the public universities and colleges. They're not for profit. So any excess revenue that they make over and above their operating expenses, they are committed by law to reinvesting those funds into the basic mission of the institution, which is education and learning. And different institutions, you know, define their mission in different ways, but it all comes back to education and learning. By contrast, the for-profit institutions do not have that. They're not obligated to take the revenues and reinvest them in their mission. Rather, their excess revenues, they use for more recruitment of students. They engage in very substantial recruiting, as if, you know, you're selling a timeshare, that kind of thing. And they use them for profits. So these institutions, which have been around for a long time, but the top 14 or so of them became publicly traded on Wall Street beginning in the 1990s, and were very successful right up through 2008, even when many other companies were really seeing their profits decline rapidly. These organizations continued to do very well and made a lot of profits off of their students.
Mm-hmm. I guess the thing that confuses me a little bit about it is that this word profit, it's not like the nonprofits don't make an excess over investment. They make a huge amount, in fact, and they can use that money in any way they want. For example, to pay a star professor $300,000 a year. And so the beneficiary of that profit is that star professor. It's true that they aren't publicly traded or anything, but also they don't pay taxes. So it just seems to me that there's we have to be really clear about this. They work in a different environment. I mean, some of these places are incredibly wealthy and don't pay any taxes and own some of the most, you know, basically some of the most valuable real estate in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, first of all, I think we need to, you know, point out that 73% of American college students are attending public universities and colleges, most of which are community colleges or their state colleges or their non-elite universities. There's just a really small, slender group of those that actually are more elite and have more substantial revenues coming in. And we tend to, you know, focus on those few, the University of Michigan, University of Virginia, et cetera, but they're the exception to the rule. And then when it too much of our discussion about higher education is driven by talking about the elite private nonprofits, the Harvards and Yales and so on, which, you know, certainly have very large endowments. But I think that skews the discussion about those schools that, because that's, you know, only a very small percentage of American college students are actually enrolled in those schools. Mm-hmm. They have their own issues. They are, all of these elite schools are important research universities, and so that's part of their mission, is that they're, you know, they're trying to set up labs for scientists who are engaged in research. But that's actually not my focus in this book. I'm really concerned about our ability as a nation to be educating more of our citizenry and enabling more people from across the income spectrum to acquire four-year college degrees.
Right. Well, let's talk just about that in public policy terms. And this is the heart of the book. What public policies. I really like the idea of a public policy that needs to be managed, because you're quite right about that. They sort of, you know, they're like dinosaurs or something. They sort of, they exist past their prime and don't operate very well. Talk about some of the policies that have hindered our ability to educate children in, or young people in, that lower quartile or lower half.
Well, because we've been talking a little bit about the public institutions, let me address that first, because okay. In some ways, you know, that's one of the very biggest issues. So throughout our history in the United States, from the creation of the Northwest Ordinance soon after the American Revolution and the founding, on down, the federal government worked hand in hand with states and with private organizations to try to expand higher education and to build what has really been a world-class system of higher education mm-hmm. in the United States. And traditionally, the federal government would provide carrots, if you will, to the states to incentivize them to invest themselves. And so after the Northwest Ordinance, through the federal government gave land grants to the states, then they started establishing very early on their own public universities and colleges. More of this happened in the 19th century after the creation of the Morrill Act, signed into law by Abraham Lincoln in 1862, and then an extension of it later on in the century. And then in the 20th century, the middle of the 20th century, the federal government creates all of these big federal student aid laws, from the GI Bill up through the Higher Education Act of 1965 and Pell Grants. And the states followed by investing more than ever in developing their public universities and colleges. So we're at a point today where the vast majority of Americans who go to college, they attend these public universities and colleges. The problem is that since the early 1990s, the states have had to pull back on how much they invest in these colleges and universities. And they've pulled back quite substantially. So the per pupil funding has dropped by 26% in real terms. And funding has dropped in, you know, per capita and as a percentage of state budgets and in just about every way you can measure it. And so what this means is that what the institutions have had to do instead in order to pay their bills in a time when costs for higher education have been going up, what they've done is to shift the burden to students and their families. And so tuition has gone up over the same period from 1990 to 2010. Mm-hmm. It went up by about 113% in real terms. So this really puts a lot of pressure on low to middle income people who particularly look to the public sector for going to college. It also means that the public universities and colleges have had to squeeze resources to squeeze more students into the classroom per faculty member, to have more online teaching, which, you know, there's a lot of excitement about the possibilities inherent in online teaching, but the public universities and colleges have been using it mostly as a cost savings measure. And what we find is that students enrolled in those classes are much more likely to drop out and not to complete the course.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to work very well pedagogically as yet. You know, we probably can continue to develop our understanding of the best practices for that sort of approach to education, but we're not there yet. And also they've had to cut back on the support services for students. So all of these things have the impact of low graduation rates, students dropping out and not continuing, not being able to afford to continue, and not being sufficiently able to keep up with things because they don't have the support.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, the big thing I would mention. And what's happened is that states have had competing demands. They've had to increase what they're spending on Medicaid and K-12 education and incarceration. All of these things are mandatory forms of spending for states, whereas higher education is the largest discretionary area of spending that states engage in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has borne the brunt. So that's one of the big areas I focus on in the book. I also talk about what's happened at the national level or federal level. Here, for a long period of time, what the federal government devotes to low-income students through Pell Grants was falling behind in real terms from when it was created in the early 1970s, and not keeping up. Now, just recently, we have increased again quite dramatically what we're spending on Pell Grants. That's happened from 2009 and 2010. Even starting before that, since around 2000, there were increases in the value of Pell Grants. But they're well behind the cost of education now because it's gone up much more quickly than inflation. And so they don't have the same impact. Back in the 1970s, a Pell Grant paid for about 80% of the cost of attending a four-year public university or college. And now it pays for just over 30% of that cost for tuition, room and board and fees. So they're much less effective. Meanwhile, what the federal government has been doing instead, our new area of spending over the past couple of decades, has been through the tax system. So this started under Clinton, that we allow people to get some money back through the tax system in proportion to what they're paying for tuition. The problem is that this kind of public policy does not actually increase the percentage of people who get college degrees. It doesn't enable people who wouldn't go to college otherwise to say, oh, now I can afford it. And that's because of the way the policy is delivered, which is long after tuition is paid, people get this perk back through the tax system. So it's not a very effective public policy.
Mm-hmm. You said a lot there, and there's a lot to kind of grapple onto. I have taught in a variety of circumstances, and one of them was actually at a large land-grant college in the Midwest where I saw a lot of what you were talking about. And I did teach online courses, and what you say is correct. Where actually to start? I mean, I guess one thing that listeners might want to know is this. I used to be the director of undergraduate studies in a department, and people would come to me and say, should I go to college? And I would say, well, yes, if you get a certain GPA in this state, you are guaranteed a place at this college and you will definitely get a loan. You should do it. And that was true of everybody that walked in my office, rich or poor. They would get a loan. At what point do we say we're asking students to shoulder too much of the burden? Because, you know, again, from the perspective of equity, if the student does take the loan, and if they do try really hard in school, and if they do complete the course, assuming they're treated equally, and I think at this place they were, then they're going to be able to pay off that loan, and they've been afforded the opportunity to go to college.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is a great question to ask, and I like the way you phrased it. There has been a growing concern about student indebtedness in the United States, and with good reason, but we tend to treat the topic in too simplistic a fashion. What I would say is that we need to look at the institution that a young person attends, and that makes such a big difference because if a student goes to a school with a very high graduation rate and they're borrowing money to go there, that might be warranted because they're going to graduate and then they're going to very likely have a substantially higher income than they would have if they'd never gone to college, and they're going to be able to pay off that loan, and that's an appropriate sort of investment for them to have made and for the American public to be making in them and so on. If, however, they go to a school with really poor graduation rates and they're just going to become indebted and they're going to end up dropping out, then they're going to be worse off. And ultimately, if they default, then the American public is on the hook. Mm-hmm. But also, that student is going to have this terrible debt hanging around their neck as well. And so that's what we really need to look at. So I would say, Well, debt is not all created equal, that you really need to look at the institution that a student is attending. Public universities and colleges have become, you know, much more expensive for people to afford, but they're still the best deal in town. So often a person who's going to a for-profit college could be going to a public college, getting the same training for a fraction of the price, and that would be a much smarter move for them to make. They would be borrowing much less than they would be going for profit, so that would be a wise call.
Mm-hmm. So to continue that line of thought, I'm thinking about a state legislature in this state, this university where I taught in the Midwest, and that state legislature receives, as they receive every year, line item for the big university. And it's increased from last year. Why would the state legislator approve that increase? Well, I mean, what argument could be made to that gal or guy that the university needs more money in terms of this kind of issue? If you see what I mean, in terms of graduation rates, in terms of paying for underprivileged children.
Yeah. Well, historically in the United States, if there's one public policy that people have really rallied around, it's been education. And we have this long tradition of thinking of higher education, as well as K-12 education, as being an important public good. Mm-hmm. It's a way to, that Americans have accepted, if you look at, public opinion polling over time, people are often somewhat ambivalent about establishing greater equality through social welfare policies, but they will applaud the idea of creating equal opportunity by enabling people to pursue as much education as they are willing to pursue. There is that tradition. For states that want to develop their economy, investing in human capital and the workforce is critical, of course. And then in terms of dealing with all kinds of social issues, can be much less expensive to do so by creating a more educated citizenry than paying for those costs if you don't do that. So, this is what traditionally state legislatures have been willing to do. And so the aberration is that in the past couple of decades that states are not doing that, that they're in many ways their hands are tied, because unlike the federal government, most states have to have a balanced budget. So if they have these growing demands in these other areas, then they are spending less on their state universities and colleges.
Yes, the state I'm talking about had to have a balanced budget.
Yeah.
I was very proud of that balanced budget, but I don't know. What you say is convincing to me. Maybe that university should hire you to go up to talk to them. Tell us a little bit more about attempts to regulate the for-profits and how you see them playing into the mix. Because in some places in the book, you are very complimentary. And then in other places in the book, you're very critical. And I think Americans, me included, don't really understand what's going on here, because a kind of new service is being offered to us and we don't quite know what it is.
Yeah. Well, in fact, the for-profits are not really new. Now, there are a few of them, like DeVry and Strayer, that were created in the late 19th and early 20th century, so they go way back. Mm-hmm. But when the first GI Bill was created after World War II, it provided a lot of federal funding for vocational training for veterans and on-the-job training. And so immediately there was the development of all these new schools and programs that hadn't existed before that fit this model. At the time, they were not called for-profits, though technically they were, but they were called trade schools and the like. And as soon as that happened, problems also began to emerge that Congress and presidential commissions became very concerned about, because they thought that a lot of these schools were gouging prices and they were charging just as much as the federal GI Bill benefit enabled them to take advantage of. And they thought some of them were providing shoddy training. So there were all sorts of investigations and hearings and the like. And then with the Korean War GI Bill, we began to regulate these schools a bit. But the same kind of cycle continued once the trade schools became eligible, their students became eligible for using funds from civilian student aid after the creation of the Higher Education Act. And again, all of these schools grew and expanded overnight and lined up in order to try to take advantage of the federal funding. And there were lots of concerns on the part of members of Congress. And so throughout the 1980s, there were all kinds of investigations going on. And finally, in the early 1990s, Congress enacted a few regulations on these and put in place what was then called the 85-15 rule. And it was building off of a rule that had been applied to the Korean War GI Bill. And that is that these schools could get no more than 85% of their revenues from the federal government through student aid. The rest had to come from some other source. This rule got watered down in 1998 to being the 90-10 rule. So, and that's what's in place today. So today, these for-profit colleges, like the University of Phoenix, which is owned by the Apollo Group, and Education Management Corporation, and so on, these schools are enabled by law to receive up to 90% of their revenues from the federal government, and actually from just one public policy, the Higher Education Act, Title IV, which is Pell Grants and Student Loans. Now, that does not even include what they can get from the military-related education programs, such as the GI Bill. So they can get more over and above that. It's really a loophole. So they could be, theoretically, they could be entirely funded by the federal government. And in fact, of those large ones, on average, they receive 86% of their revenues from the federal government and, do very well on Wall Street, meanwhile. So American taxpayers are really subsidizing these schools almost entirely. We call them for-profit, which makes them sound like they're private, but for the most part, they are publicly funded organizations. So what I would say, we've been in a period of deregulation of these from 1998 through 2006. There have been efforts in the past few years during the Obama administration to create new regulations, but some of them were created and then thrown out by a judge, the gainful employment rules, and now there's another set being created. I believe that Congress needs to act and needs to regulate these schools, and that we are obligated as a nation to do that. The problem is that for students who undergo the heavy recruitment these schools engage in, there's an information asymmetry. So as consumers, these students are being sold a bill of goods that they have very little knowledge about, but they're signing on the dotted line and taking out loans before they enroll. And then as soon as they do, many of them realize, oh, this school is not what I thought it was, but they're already on the hook. Education is different than buying a car in all sorts of ways. It's harder to assess, particularly for someone who's from a family or community where almost no one's gone to college. It's much harder to assess the value of it before you're already immersed in it. And as well, it's a different kind of thing than buying a car because it's a public good that all that, in American society, we think of it as a right for people. We also think of acquiring a college education as something that can help society more broadly through economic development mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. So I believe we're really obligated to try to regulate these for-profits. The other thing is that, taxpayers are on the hook for the large amount of money. We now spend, of the amount we spend on federal student aid, $1 in $4 is going to the for-profits. Mm-hmm. They enroll only 13% of students. but they're using a much greater percentage of federal student aid, and yet they have the lowest graduation rates by far of any sector. And so we really need to find a way to hold them accountable. We should be holding all sorts of institutions accountable. I'm singling out the for-profits, though, because there is a prevalence of bad actors there. And so we really need to take action.
Yeah, again, you raise a lot of points. One that occurs to me, and I just am speaking from a point of view of ignorance, why is the government regulating where businesses get their income?
What do you mean?
Well, why should it? I mean, you know, there's a Korean grocery store down the street. The government doesn't tell them, okay, a certain percentage of your income can come from food stamps and no more than that.
Oh, I see. Well, you know, the problem is if you have organizations that really might not even exist were it not for government funds, and yet, you know, and they're serving their clients, their customers poorly, the outcomes are really poor, and they're leaving taxpayers on the hook. That's problematic.
Yeah, but couldn't it also be said, and I'm just playing devil's advocate here, couldn't it also be said that the defense industry, the defense contractors, they basically live and die from the government?
Yeah, that's true, absolutely. But here we're talking about the provision of a, you know, something we consider a human right, and you have students being taken advantage of through the process.
Right. So, just to focus on that point for a moment, again, as a devil's advocate, shouldn't people be free to decide where they want to go to school?
Yes, they should be free. But, you know, we have a long history of consumer regulation in the United States. We want people, when they are acting as consumers, to be able to have some guarantee that what they are putting themselves at risk for by either spending their money or even going into debt, as the case is here, that they are going to be getting a good or service that is worth it. And so that's what I'm saying, is that we need to protect consumers.
Right. But the nonprofit, that is the regular educational institutions, having worked in them for decades now, they offer no such guarantee. They offer no guarantee at all of any outcome.
Right. But
I wish they did.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about how can we do that. The for-profits exist for the explicit purpose of giving people training for gainful employment in particular trades and occupations. So, you know, the question is, do they do that successfully? And if people are not able to repay their loans, if they graduate from these schools, which, you know, if they're among the 22% who actually graduate, then are they able to, do employers recognize those degrees and hire them? You know, these schools have the highest default rates by far. They account for nearly half of all student loan defaults. So, you know, that doesn't seem to be happening.
Yeah, that's a good point. But again, I'm reminded of graduate school in my field's history. Half of the people that go to graduate school in history around the nation don't complete their degree. Of those, half of them never get jobs. So there's something going wrong there, too. I mean, they're not regulated at all.
Well,
and these are big institutions, Harvard's and Yale's and Berkeley's and Michigan's and Cornell's and, you know.
Yeah. No, certainly, I mean, there is a call right now by the Obama administration for all universities and colleges to be subjecting themselves to making more data readily accessible to consumers so that they can see, you know, what the graduation rates are like and what subsequent earnings are like and so on. I have a particular concern about the for-profits doing that. Most people who go to PhD programs these days are able to go into it with their eyes wide open. They, you know, I speak with these students regularly and they're asking, well, you know, what are your placement rates for your graduates and where do they go on to teach and where do they get hired and so forth and so on. And they're pretty savvy consumers, whereas the for-profits tend to be recruiting students who, as I said, are the first in their family or community to be going to college. They really don't have that information. And even if we make a lot of data available, I don't think that's necessarily going to help, because you're talking about people who are, you know, often they're very young, they're 18-year-olds, and the data itself might not help to give them the wake-up call that they need, that right. unfortunately many of them get too late when they're already on the hook.
Right. So you wouldn't say there's any educational fix for this. You know, for example, if we have consumers, you know, I'm thinking of the loan market. Obviously, there was some bad acting there, and people were not acting under full information of what was going on. And some people said, well, we've had this educational program that will, like, tell everybody how loans work. You can't imagine that any such educational program could work for the for-profits. And we say, okay, these are the colleges that are out there, and these are the risks. Yeah. You know, so well, tell every high school senior this.
It would certainly help. And, you know, the problem is that the opposite happens. For people who live in low-income communities, for most of them, the only colleges that they hear about are the for-profits. The for-profits come to their high schools and do recruitment. They advertise in subways and on billboards and late-night television and so on. And they're not being reached out to very much by traditional universities and colleges. So, you know, the opposite thing is happening of what you're suggesting. And I think education is a first step, but I actually think it would be far more effective and more responsible for the federal government to at least restore the kind of regulations that we had in the early 1990s that were created by Democrats and Republicans alike at that time period, mm-hmm. And for which there's now so little support.
Are public institutions, you know, community and colleges and stuff, are they subject to the 90-10 rule?
No, they are not subject to the 90-10 rule. And of course, you know, they get a lot of public funding, but students also dig deep, and pay tuition to attend them. Mm-hmm. And that's because, you know, people value what they produce. And there's a long history of people knowing in their states about other people in their communities who've gone to attend these same universities and colleges and have had a, you know, valuable experience there.
Yeah.
So the same can't be said.
I'm tipping my hand here. I love community colleges. I think it's the best higher education program the United States ever constructed, because they're just fantastic places. They really are.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what I would like to do is to shift funding away from the for-profits, which have such poor outcomes, and shift it to the community colleges, which are so underfunded, and which are trying to do really fantastic things on a shoestring.
Yeah, they are.
And so that's where I would put a lot of money.
And they do fantastic things. I should give a shout out to the community college, which was near this university where I taught, and they used to send me students that had finished the 2-year degree there, and they were super prepared. And I was just, yeah. I was so happy to have them. We talked a lot about these for-profit institutions. I guess one last question. You don't see the market rectifying the situation. In other words, you know, these people compete for students, these corporations do, and one has to imagine, I used to work in a corporation, one has to imagine that they sit in a room saying, how can we get Phoenix's students? And, you know, sure, advertising will do it, but also if we increased our retention rate and we could publicize that. And
well, you know, they actually are able to spend a lot on their marketing, whereas public universities and colleges, especially community colleges, are not able to do that. They don't have that kind of budget. And so, you know, it's not a simple case where the laws of economics will just help to root out the bad actors.
Right. Well, I would say one proviso to that is that this place, the University of Iowa, I'll tell you what it is, had an institution called the Hawkeyes. It was a football team, mm-hmm. and it was the greatest mm-hmm. recruitment device on earth. And they got a lot of free television time.
Well, that is,
yes,
that
a lot of free national television time that I don't think any for-profit gets. So, in fact, they got paid to be on television.
Right. So yeah. No. Better. Well, that is the case about college sports.
Yeah.
Here,
so
right?
That's a really good thing there. So, I guess this is I'm hesitant to ask this question, but you know, in a kind of blue sky way, you've talked a little bit about it already, and we agree there's a problem. What should be done to fix it, where it is returning the United States and its educational system back to the day in which the less prosperous among us were given a ladder they could climb into the middle class and the whole citizenry could be better educated than it is now. Which is, yeah. I think we all want that. Everybody on every
right.
side of this
it's,
debate.
It's exactly what we want. Well, you know, I could give a long laundry list because in many ways that's what it takes. But I guess I want to first look at the big picture because that's most important. I think we need to step back and look at our history and see how we have this tradition as a nation of investing in higher education for broad public purposes. Too often now we speak of higher education as if it's simply a private good that enables people to, you know, be better off themselves. And that's not necessarily a worthwhile rationale for why government should be investing much more in it. You know, it's very nice for those individuals that they get to go on and have a more comfortable standard of living for themselves and their families. But why should government be subsidizing all of that? I think that's a really fair question. However, in fact, we know that higher education has all of these public benefits as well that are really crucial and really important. And that's what we need much more of. We need to be investing mm-hmm. in human capital in this country, and we need to be mitigating inequality and so on. And so we need to find ways to do it. So how to do it, the actual practicalities, there's lots of detail there, but we need to find a way to reinvest in public universities and colleges, particularly the kinds of, you know, state colleges and community colleges that have really been suffering over the past couple of decades from lack of funding. We need to regulate the for-profits so that we don't have a growing underclass of people who have these great aspirations to pursue the American dream and end up worse off than if they'd never gone to college in the first place. We do need to hold both public and private, nonprofit and profit colleges accountable when they receive student aid, that, you know, that they are being good actors. There's real variation among the private elites, for example, in terms of the percentage of Pell Grant recipients that they take in and the extent to which they supplement their Pell Grant funding with additional aid that will really enable them to graduate. And so I think we should be, you know, trying to move more of them in the direction of being really responsible actors, given the amount of federal aid that they receive. Those are a few of the things that I would mention.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic or pessimistic at this point?
Oh, well, when you look at what's happened over the past couple of decades, you know, one can get quite pessimistic. But when I look at our longer history, it makes me more optimistic because we really have such an amazing tradition in the United States of, you know, being a leader in higher education. And we were until recently. I mean, people of my generation, I graduated from college in 1984. For myself and for my older siblings, our cohort group was the most highly educated. We as Americans were the most highly educated of anyone in the world at that point in time. There was a higher percentage of college graduates in the United States than any other nation. But since then, we've fallen behind to about 11th. All these other nations have leapfrogged over us, and we've not been making progress. So, but I think, you know, we did it in the past, and we can restore that.
Yeah, I don't know. We have to, I guess I work on the internet a lot now. And so I talk to internet entrepreneurs, and I've taught online classes myself, and I've used computers a lot in classes. I don't use them so much anymore, actually. I didn't use them as much as I did. I'm back to chalk. But in any event, I really think that the internet is going to change dramatically the way all institutions deliver learning. I really do. I think we're in the infancy of these for-profit institutions. If they are to be extinguished, so to say, it will be the nonprofits that do it because they will learn how to do it better. And the for-profits do. There's no guarantee that will happen. But it's interesting. I'll just tell you my experience with online teaching. it's true that over half of the kids that enrolled in my classes failed, literally got Fs every time I taught these classes, and I taught them for a few years. Mm-hmm. But they failed because they didn't complete the class, not because they couldn't do the work. There was nothing wrong with the way I taught it. There was something wrong with the way they thought about it, and they just didn't do it, and so they failed. Yeah. But the online class, which had a parallel live class, the online class was harder, and I made it harder because they lacked that sort of live component. And for those students that did really well in that online class, and there weren't very many of them, I have to admit, you know, so they were really good. So it was sort of bimodal. There were a lot of Fs and a lot of A's. And what I want to do, what I would hope that these people learn how to do, and Lord knows they're waiting for their Steve Jobs or Henry Ford or I don't know who, is to get more A's. You know what I'm saying? Get people to take these things more seriously, because I think that's possible. I really do. I, again, when I have to learn something new now about computers or whatever it is, especially if it's a technical skill, I don't take a class even at the local community college. I take an online class to do it.
Right.
Because I know how to do this thing. And I was going to say, the economies of it are incredible. I don't have to pay anything for this education. But again, I'm a particular kind of person who knows how to learn something from a big box. I can learn something from a box.
That's what the research seems to be showing. You know, the people who, like very large number of people enroll in MOOCs, in the massive online courses. But the people who actually complete them, who are very few, are people who are already highly educated.
So they are people who have
learned how to learn. They know how to be students, so they can work quite independently. But the students that we need to be most concerned about, who really need to be getting college degrees, don't necessarily have that sort of preparation to succeed in that. But, you know, I also agree with you that going forward, we need to find appropriate pedagogies that work best, probably some combination of brick and mortar and online experiences for particular classes and through and for a whole academic program that helps to incorporate.
I love teaching online. I really liked it just because it was a new experience for me. And also, I know some of the students loved it as well. Again, there were those students that just disappeared. But in my live class, there were students that just disappear. I mean, that doesn't so much happen at Cornell. I used to teach at another place like Cornell, and people didn't just disappear. But the college wouldn't let them disappear. They come after you at Cornell. So absenteeism of that kind is pretty common in both, but much more common in the online class. But as I say, you know, the great educational reformer, whoever it's going to be that's going to figure out how to do all this, she's not here yet. I hope she shows up, because it's a huge economy. The internet just affords an absolutely incredible economy in terms of the delivery of education, I think. It really does. So who can tell?
That's right.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Suzanne. Let me conclude the interview by asking you our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now? Or maybe you're just taking a rest from this book.
Yeah, I do need to recuperate a little bit from Degrees of Inequality. But, I have many projects that I'm working on. The book that I wrote previous to this one was called The Submerged State, which is about how in the United States today, in fact, we have a vast array of different kinds of government programs and types of spending, but some of them are delivered in a way that's pretty hidden from public view, such as through the tax code. And so people don't really recognize that government's doing anything for them. My next book will pick up where that book left off and look at how changes in American social welfare policies from the 1970s to the present have affected people's attitudes about government and their participation in politics.
Sorry, I was going to say, never mind. I was going to say welfare queens, you know, because there's that whole thing about the way Americans see welfare. The other thing about, I'm sorry to digress here for a second, but having lived in Europe, I always tell Americans that we don't have any welfare system, because we don't have the dole, for example. Mm-hmm. And most Americans don't realize this, that, you know, that actually our welfare system is just so entirely different. So they just have no conception that it's really unique among developed nations. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're quite right about that.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that we actually are kind of in the middle of the road among the developed nations in terms of how much we devote to social welfare spending, but we deliver it through different ways, mm-hmm. more through private organizations and through the tax code rather than just direct public services. Mm-hmm. And we also devote more of it to people who are pretty high up on the income spectrum by contrast to European countries.
That's not so good. Well, never mind, I said that.
Well, that's a discussion for the next time you call me up.
Yeah, I don't know. Don't write me letters. Don't send me emails. I don't know. You get what you get. Okay, that's great. Today we've been talking to Suzanne Mettler about her book, Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotage the American Dream. Suzanne, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Marshall. I've really enjoyed chatting with you.
Absolutely my pleasure. And let me tell everybody who listens to this podcast, thank you very much. And I hope you have a good weekend. It's going to be the 4th, so have a good 4th of July for those of you in the United States.